the course about basic Judaism, particularly aimed at helping people to understand Jewish life and conversion. Now, the question you must face, as I'm sure you are, is should I convert to Judaism? Once again, welcome this evening. Now, this information that I'm about to start is for those who are indeed serious about learning Judaism, because conversion to Judaism means accepting the Jewish faith and becoming part of the eternal Jewish people. Judaism, in many generations, welcomed and still does sincere converts. In fact, to go back to the very origin, Abraham and Sarah, Abraham and Sarah, husband and wife, the founders of the Jewish people, were not born Jewish. And we are told by the Talmud that they engaged in conversion, not only themselves, but in welcoming others who wished to join the belief in one invisible, indivisible God, and we will describe him in a little bit. Throughout the ages, untold numbers of people have converted to Judaism and have made major contributions to Jewish life, Jewish law, Jewish faith, Jewish literature. There have been those who have converted to Judaism and have brought us great pain, frustration, and disappointment. In the United States today, they say that there are over 200,000 people who have chosen to accept the Jewish faith. Unfortunately, not all of them have joined it with sincerity and the commitment to be religious, observant, Orthodox Jews for the rest of their lives. So, if you are considering becoming Jewish, here are some suggestions that you should indeed explore one at a time. I know that you are considering and you're thinking about conversion. Do it. People choose to become Jewish for many different reasons. Some come to Judaism after a long spiritual search. Many people who eventually convert had their interest sparked because of a romantic relationship with someone who is Jewish. Among the reasons most often given by people who do convert are: 1. Judaism has sensible religious beliefs. 2. Becoming a Jew allows the convert to share the faith of a partner. 3. Becoming Jewish makes the family religiously united. 4. Becoming Jewish will make it easier for children by giving them a clear religious identity. 5. Becoming Jewish means joining an eternal, persecuted, but blessed people. Think about your own reasons. Remember, conversion must be of your own free choice, not because of pressure or out of a desire to be with someone, but rather out of a genuine desire to embrace Judaism. Learn as much as you can about Judaism, law, history, religion, thought, philosophy, literature. Learn to read Hebrew. Some reading suggestions are found in the accompanying page in which you have suggested books. Go to lectures. Take introductory courses on Judaism, which are offered by many colleges and congregations. Talk to some Jewish friends. Remember that Judaism has an important ethnic component. You are joining a people, not just a religion, and so need to learn about different aspects of Jewish culture and about Israel and about different kinds of Jews in terms of dress and idea and approach to life and religiosity, etc. See if Judaism's basic beliefs and practices make sense to you. Remember that Judaism is a faith of good deeds, not forced creeds. There is more concern in Judaism that you act morally than having specific beliefs, although beliefs are an essential part of Judaism. All Jews share a passion to make the world a better place. Jews have been described as a light unto the nations. To get started, here are some general Jewish beliefs that are widely held among Jews. One, Judaism introduced the world to the idea that God is one, not many, and God is kind, loving, personal, and the judge as well. In Judaism, we pray directly to God. We don't need any emissary to intervene. And one can receive help, guidance, and understanding from Him, with a capital H. You can pray on your own, or with a prayer community in a congregation. Judaism accepts the idea of a covenant or agreement between God and the Jewish people. In fact, my great teacher, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik of blessed memory, often referred to us as a covenantal community, which means we have certain obligations that we have accepted upon ourselves, and there's an agreement with God that He has accepted us as well. Two, Judaism does not accept the idea that people are born evil. The opposite is true. We believe that every human being is born good, becomes evil because of influences. People have free will to choose between right and wrong and will be either rewarded or punished for their choice and their action, either in this world or in a spiritual, eternal world. Three, Judaism encourages religious freedom of thought. Judaism welcomes probing questions, spiritual questions, questions about Jewish law. Judaism has, number four, Judaism has for 4,000 years emphasized a strong sense of family and the importance of a close Jewish community. Experience Judaism as it is lived. Visit a congregation to sample a service or attend a Jewish ceremony such as Pesach, Passover, Seder, or a Shabbos meal. You may not know what it's all about at first, and it'll look very strange to you, but only through visiting again and again, experiencing, you will see that there is order, there is understanding, there is religious thought and participation in Judaism and your friends. While ritual practices vary greatly among the Jews throughout the world, and American Jews as well, there are some mitzvos, rituals, that are common to every Jewish family. Celebration of Jewish holidays, weddings, bris, pidyon haben, all of which we'll get into individually. You should visit such places as a Jewish bookstore, a Jewish museum, community centers, and therefore meet and see the type of programs that go on in the Jewish community. Talk about your thoughts and feelings with your friends, with your partner, and your family. It is important to discuss your feelings openly. It is common to experience some moments of doubt or fear of the unknown. It's also vital that you stay in touch with your birth family. There are some rabbis who insist that a convert must cut all ties with biological families. You must respect and accept the opinion of your rabbi. In general, converting to Judaism does not mean you are abandoning your family or friends or your fond memories of your past family life. When discussing conversion with your family, explain your reasons to them directly and tell them of your continuing love for them. Most families are supportive, often to the surprise of the person who wants to convert. Some families, however, do need reassurance and to have their questions answered patiently. There are also some families who see conversion to Judaism as an abandonment and disloyalty and will never accept it. At some point in learning about Judaism, preferably as early as possible, but especially as you get more serious about actually becoming Jewish, you must talk to a rabbi. As you study and learn about Judaism, you will read about different religious movements within Judaism. I immediately stop at this point and say to you, my friend, that in my humble opinion, there are only two movements or two ways or people who are Jewish. There are those who are religious, observant, Orthodox Jews, and the not yet religious, observant, Orthodox Jews. But there are denominations, and it's important to understand the differences between the various quote-unquote branches. For example, the Orthodox rabbinate does not generally, or at all, recognize conversions performed by non-Orthodox rabbis. Different movements may have different conversion requirements. And there are steps that you should take before you convert to Judaism. Most of you have already started on that because you are here. Find a rabbi. You will be discouraged and turned away at least three times. And this is a test of how sincere the would-be convert is in wishing to become Jewish. After finding a rabbi, there's a period of study, at least 1 year, according to the dictates and the mandates of the Rabbinical Council of America in this area, to learn such matters as Jewish belief, rituals, laws, and prayers. The study might involve working directly with a rabbi, either individually or in a group, and introduction to Jewish law and practices as indicated. Orthodox and some conservative require all candidates for conversion to go through not only a learning process, testing, evaluation, but also eventually to go to a ritual bath called a mikveh. The candidate is immersed in the mikveh in the presence of a beddin of three Orthodox rabbis, and there are beautiful prayers that are recited at that time. Male candidates for conversion have to be circumcised. If one is already circumcised, then there is a symbolic circumcision, which is called hatafat dam, that you will learn about in the future. The candidate for conversion will appear before a beddin or religious court consisting of three rabbis, preferably learned men, to see that all steps of the conversion process have been done properly. A Hebrew name is chosen. Sometimes there's a beautiful ceremony that is held celebrating the conversion. Conversion is a challenge, but almost all those who have gone through it describe it as exciting, inspiring, as a time of real personal and spiritual growth, and as a time of intensified feelings of love and closeness to God, to the Jewish people, to the Jewish family. I know you are considering, and I wish you the best of everything. At any moment that you feel that this is not your cup of tea, it would be advisable for you to step out, contemplate, and above all, rejoin the religion into which you were born. In fact, I heartily urge and advise that you do not move into a process of conversion to Judaism until you have first discussed this with your local priest or minister. It is only fair that the representative of the religion into which you were born should be given an opportunity to discuss why you should remain in that religion. Now we're going to go on in this tape. There is a bit of a hiatus, just ignore it for the next few minutes, but we're going on to the subject of tonight, which will be terminal illness, euthanasia, Jewish ideas about life and birth, etc. Good luck. Amos, chapter 8, verses 7 through 13, says, "Behold, days will come, says the Lord God, when I will send a famine unto the land. Not a famine for bread, nor for water, but to listen and understand the words of the Lord. And they will wander from sea to sea, and from the north to the east. They will grope around to search for the word of the Lord, and they will not find it. But on that day will the beautiful maidens and the young men faint of thirst. Those days have arrived to a great degree. We live in an age when young people all over the world are searching for the ground of being the spiritual reality which forms the basis of this world. A part of this movement is also to search for one's roots, universally, nationally, and individually. Today, the Jew is involved with even deeper search for true identity, which is bound up with the spiritual guide, the Almighty God, of the nation of Israel. Unfortunately, many people are searching, and many people are groping, but they are not finding exactly what is the way of life best suited to the Jew. The way of life, which is represented by Torah and mitzvot, all of which will become quite clear and apparent as these sessions and lectures continue. Jewish tradition says that Torah existed before the world and will continue to exist after the world ends. That the Almighty God, whom we call Hashem, looked into the Torah and created the world. And that if Jews stopped studying Torah, the world would cease to exist. Now, these are very strong statements, I know, and probably understood in a very shallow manner, both by the Jew, especially one who has been primarily educated in secular schools and accustomed to the Western culture view, and by the non-Jew as well, because the belief there is that the Bible is just another book on the shelf. Put very succinctly, the Torah is the foundation, the blueprint, and guidebook of the Jews' existence and, in fact, the entire world's existence. The Creator established a path to follow so that His creatures, you and I, would know how to use the complex life which we have been granted. This instruction book is called Torah and includes the 5 books of Moses, 8 books of the prophets, and 11 books of the writings, and Talmud, commonly known as Gemara. As we approach Rosh Hashanah, as we are in the fall season, a simple idea, which is very profound, really, of a message that the Jew learns and repeats every single year, just to see whether this is really your cup of tea. One of the prayers that we utter in the special book called the Marzo of Rosh Hashanah states that this day is the beginning of your work, speaking to God, a memoriam for the first day, for it is an ordinance for Israel, a judgment for the God of Jacob. This day is the beginning of God's work. No, it's not. Rosh Hashanah marks the day on which man was created, and that was on the 6th and the last day of creation. Rather than being the beginning of the divine works, it was the end. When man came into being, the earth, the sun, the moon, the stars, the galaxies, the rivers, the oceans, the mountains, the vegetation, all forms of life were already in existence. The message is quite clear. An artist may spend days and weeks assembling all the materials he needs for his painting, but the actual work does not begin until he touches the brush to the canvas. All that preceded was indeed essential to the work, but was not the work itself. We are told here that the work of creation begins with man. Everything else in the universe, from the tiniest subatomic particle to the greatest galaxy, is but preparatory to man. Man is thus the essence of the entire universe and the goal of all creation. Now, this places an awesome responsibility upon man. He cannot live his life like the subhuman species, because they are here in the universe only to make man's existence possible. As the ultimate purpose of creation, therefore, man must search for the purpose of his existence and how he can best achieve it, because all else in the universe is the means, whereas he is the end. Because man is the end of creation, he is the beginning of God's works. And today I should take upon myself the following advices, a great Rabbi Abraham J. Tversky, M.D., try to search for the meaning of my existence and dedicate myself to finding and fulfilling the purpose for which I was created. The Baal Shem Tov, founder of the Hasidic movement in the 18th century, taught that a person must be extremely cautious not to pass harsh judgment on others. It is yourself, he said, that you are judging. When the prophet Nathan rebuked King David following the Bathsheba incident, you can ask about what that was, he related the parable of the wealthy man who owned abundant livestock and who robbed a poor neighbor of his one and only lamb. David was outraged at this terrible injustice, and in his anger he exclaimed, "I swear by God that man is deserving of death, that person." And Nathan said to him, "You are that man." This is found in Samuel 2, chapter 12, verses 1 to 5. On the days of judgment, the books of our deeds are opened, and they read on their very own our actions, which speak for themselves. And the seal of each person's hand is therein. That is, we have rendered our own judgment on our actions by the way we reacted to similar actions when we observed them in others. God merely carries out the judgments we have made on ourselves. So, therefore, try to be considerate when judging other people's behavior, remembering that there may be extenuating circumstances that might account for their actions. A third and final thought for today, before we get into the topic of terminal illness and euthanasia, etc., is that in our prayer book it says, and we pray to God, as a father is merciful toward his children, so may you be merciful to us. As children of God, we have the right to plead for mercy, just as we would expect a human father to be kind and compassionate with his child. Actions that might elicit stern judgment from strangers do not provoke a similar reaction from one's father. And in praying for divine forgiveness for our misdeeds, we are therefore not asking for the extraordinary, but simply for the natural response of a father toward a child. And therefore, we have an obligation that today I shall try to behave in a manner that befits the child of the Almighty God. During these days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we recite the prayer and recall God, Avinu Malkeinu, our Father, our King. We should give thought to the concept of reverence for our fathers, and at the same time remember that God is our King, and therefore will judge us. And he will judge us on the basis of the fact that we know we are children of God and act accordingly. The baby, and most people say under the lip, under the nose, and the upper lip, and that's how we get that cleft. And the baby forgets all of the Torah, and is born, comes out into this world, and has to spend a lifetime learning Torah again. But back here in the psyche, subconscious mind, that Jewish child, boy and girl, has an entire encyclopedia of Torah, which if the right buttons are pressed in Jewish education, then this comes to the fore. The convert has the same, whatever you want to ask me, Vicky, the story with a non-Jew. The convert, I think I told you this once before, if not I'll repeat it again and again, he believed that a righteous
convert has a soul that really is Jewish. But that soul got lost in the course of history. The soul wandered away from Mount Sinai when the soul heard the Decalogue, the giving of the Ten Commandments, the Jews saying, Na'aseh v'nishma, we shall do and we shall learn. And somehow or other, over the course of time, ended up in the body of a non-Jewish woman. And that soul gave, that baby that was born with a Jewish soul, had to come back to Judaism, boy or girl, somehow or other. And those are the righteous converts in this world, those who join the Jewish religion, and they become Gerei HaTzedek, as it's called. They are committed and honest with themselves and with God, and they remain that way. Those are the righteous converts. Those souls are also taught Torah. So it's back there. And all it needs is a good teacher or a good friend to trigger and to awaken the computer. There's a memory bank. How many of you work with computers here? You know, the computer has a memory bank, and you have to press the right button to bring up through a window or whatever it's called. I know nothing about computers except the language a little bit, the interface, you know. So therefore, the learning of Torah is a relearning for Jews and for those who have Jewish souls of that which we once knew and we have forgotten. Now, does God do a thing like that? Why teach the whole Torah to a soul, to a baby, and then make him forget it? It teaches us many things. Number one, that the child, according to us in Jewish education, is not an empty shell. There is something there. And the education is supposed to awaken whatever is there. That's number one. Number two is to teach us also that no one is able to learn the Torah and achieve knowledge of Torah easily. An angel who teaches Torah in a mother's womb is a very easy way of learning Torah, because the angel is a perfect teacher, and the soul absorbs whatever the angel has to teach. That's easy with the umbilical cord, you know. It goes right into the kid. But if we're born and our job is to work hard and to sweat in order to achieve the knowledge of Torah, then it shows that it has value. Anything you get for nothing really has no value in the long run. Mm-hmm. It's true in anything, in business, in the professions, particularly in Judaism. There's an expression that is used by the great Rashi, Shetihiyu Amelim Batorah. We should work hard, sweat, when it comes to Torah. Child is born, it's a great simcha, great joy. Children bring a blessing. If they are normal and healthy, it's the greatest blessing of all. If they are not, God forbid, normal and healthy. Okay. 9 minutes.
We forgot about them.
They have to be together 9 minutes, and they are. Okay. Did you call the taxi?
Yes.
It's a good idea to not, because you never tell what they're doing in there.
And they should go out by themselves. Okay. Si no de la mano.
May you be successful in your process.
Thank you.
Bye, Mom. Thank you again.
You will come down to Cali. Yes. You won't suffer at all.
Join New York. Stay out of trouble in New York. Okay. Here we go.
So if the children are not healthy.
Children are not healthy? That's in the middle of the sentence. And it happens. It happens in the best of Jewish homes that children are born with some kind of problem. If it's a problem of what they call Down syndrome, mm-hmm. it happens in many, many religious families, not only non-religious families. The question is, supposing in today, mothers-to-be can be aware of the problems that are going to be forthcoming. They can take all kinds of amnio-inducive tests and sonograms and other examinations, and it can be determined whether the baby is going to be normal or not. Under those circumstances, is abortion permitted?
No.
Well, let's take a vote. All those who say no, raise a hand.
Unless the mother.
Those who say yes, raise a hand. Those who couldn't care less, raise a hand. He raised his hand. Thank you very much. I'm trying to make a little bit of laughter out of a very serious subject. You've already said what the criterion is, and that is the life of the mother. That is the major criterion. Whether the mother's life is being endangered physically or psychologically. That would determine the answer to the question whether abortion is permitted or not. In any event, the rabbi has to be consulted. A rabbi who is expert in this particular field. Not all rabbis are expert. There are specialties today. But your local Orthodox rabbi should be able to turn to someone who he trusts and honors and feels he is an expert in these questions. Sometimes the answer to abortion is no, and sometimes it's not. And that's where Jewish parents have to make the decision to live with whatever the decision is. I know of a case of a Down syndrome girl who was born to a very, very religious family. Wonderful, wonderful people. And it was complete shock because the birth mother was 25, 26 years old, and birth father 30 years old, 28 in fact. And there was no indication whatsoever of this abnormal factor. And the baby that was born a day later after the birth, the doctor informed this young couple of the problem, and it is a problem. And they did not have the amniocentesis examination, so they weren't ready for it at all. And someone suggested to them, well, give it away, because you're going to suffer a lifetime with an abnormal, quote-unquote, abnormal child. And they spoke to their rabbi, and they opted not to give the baby away. She was a cute baby now, 5-6 years of age. Very, very quiet. Down syndrome children, by the way, are very, very loving and lovable. Mm-hmm. But it's no question a headache for parents who have to worry about will this little girl grow up safely, because she has to be watched all the time, because she doesn't know the difference between right and wrong, probably will never know to some degree anyway. And what about a normal life, quote-unquote, about marriage and children and the future? All the things that every parent wants for children, and Jewish parents are no different. In fact, even more interested in that. You have to have a great deal of faith, a great deal of faith. Bitochen, it's called in Hebrew. That's part of the birth process. Now, after the child was born, it's a good idea to name the child so it doesn't go around being called it all the time. So, or he or she. And when do we name our children? Okay, girls are named because they're girls. They take precedence in all things. Women come first in Jewish life. So they are named early on. That is a day or two after the birth. They're usually named, not usually, but always named when the Torah is read. The father will come to the synagogue at an early service, let's say the child is born on Sunday. Monday morning, the Torah is read. Or Thursday morning, the Torah is read. Shabbos morning and afternoon, the Torah will be read. So he will go to the synagogue when he's able to do so, and he'll tell the people in the synagogue, I want to name my baby. They will call him to the Torah, as every Jew is called to the Torah at happy occasions. The Bar Mitzvah, the Jewish men will be called to the Torah, and he will recite the brachot, which you gentlemen who want to convert should really learn by heart. The brachot said, when one is called to the Torah, there are two short brachot. And while he's standing there, what's called an aliyah, he ascends to the Torah, and somebody will make a special prayer, and in it they will say the Karei Shema B'Yisrael, the baby, this girl, shall be known from now on among the Jewish people as, and the parents will choose a name, and the baby will be named so-and-so, the daughter of so-and-so, the father, the daughter of, and the mother's name as well. And that's done pretty quickly. The boy will be named at the Brit, at the Brit Milah, which means the eighth day, if everything is normal. It could take a lot longer, because my younger son was born and became jaundiced almost overnight after he was born, and had to do some special procedures, transanguination as it's called, and the doctor advised that the surgery, circumcision, should not be done for a full month. But we waited for a full month before the Brit Milah. During that time, we called in it. What is it doing? Why is it crying? Why is he crying? And then he was given his formal name.
Why can't there be names given even if it can't be done?
Because no, a name does not attach itself except at those occasions. Even a convert. A convert is given a name, Jewish name. When is he or she given a Jewish name? If a boy is converted, and he needs a Brit Milah, or a man to be converted, and he needs a circumcision, or Hatafat Dam Brit, let a ritual drop of blood, as the case may be, even then the name is not given to that child or man. It will be given at the time of the mikveh, when they conclude the conversion ceremony. Some rabbis give the name while the convert is standing in the water of the mikveh itself. My own practice is that the convert gets dressed, comes back into the outer room, and there we say a special prayer, giving him or her the Jewish name. And there the convert will be called, whatever name is, Ben Avraham Avinu, son of Abraham, our father, who is the father of all converts, or the female will be called Bat Avraham Avinu, the daughter of, whatever name he or she chooses, or the parents choose for them. Now, when a boy is born, it's a very old custom, and on the first Friday night after the birth, the parents will make a kind of party, invite their neighbors, and it's called a Shalom Zacha. Shalom Zacha. Hebrew words for welcome male. M-A-L-E, not M-A-I-L. Okay? It was a ceremony or a party that was exclusively done for boys for the longest time, until recently. About 30 years ago, the feminist women's movement invaded or encroached or became part of the psyche and the thinking of the Jewish girls and women who were religious and learned and went to college and so on. And they said, we ought to have something of a celebration of that kind when a girl is born. Why should girls be any different than boys? So they do have, and they call it Simchat Habat. Simchat Habat, a joyous occasion for the daughter. And they also have it on a Friday night, inviting their neighbors and friends, and serving after the meal, after they've had a regular meal at home, people will get together, and they'll have soda and cookies and chickpeas. Chickpeas are favorite food at those occasions. It's nice and round, and they proliferate, and they're all a lot together. It's kind of symbolic of having one child and wanting more. You see, that's the last thing that a pregnant woman who just had a baby wants, but okay. That's the Simchat Habat, so they kind of evened it out. Now you'll find what I'm talking about in the Jewish catalog. The Jewish catalog. The first volume, there are three volumes to it, the first one is the best part. And you'll find all of this information about naming children. Parental obligations, the Mishnah and the Talmud, very, very strict about the obligations of parents who bring children into this world. There's no such thing as having a good sexual time, getting pregnant and bringing a child into the world and then say, well, let them, him and her grow up by themselves. No man and no sir. Both parents are equally obligated. The father has his specific role in life. For instance, the Mishnah states specifically that the father is obligated to see that the child is circumcised if it's a boy, and that he learns Torah, if he can teach him himself. In fact, the father is supposed to do the circumcision too. Most fathers don't know how, so we hire somebody to do so. That's pretty prevalent in Jewish life. You hire somebody to do something for you. Did you ever hear, I'm going to tell you a humorous story. I want you to laugh. Ease up a little bit. You look a little bit too tight. Don't be so serious. You know, I poke fun at reform every once in a while. Anybody who needs a translation wants reform, you know, they're supposed to be denominations in Jewish organizational life, and the reform are Jews who are not exactly religious as we see them, as we see their lifestyle. So the fellow came to the rabbi, the reform rabbi, and said, "Rabbi," he said, "I want you to do me a good turn." "What is it?" He said, "My father just died, and I read someplace that I'm supposed to sit shiva." Anybody need a translation? Supposed to sit shiva. "But I have no time. I'm busy. In fact, I've got an appointment in L.A. tomorrow, and I have to go to Hong Kong the day after that. But I have no time to sit shiva. Would you do it for me? Sit shiva in my place?" The rabbi said, "Well, I do everything else for my congregation. I say Kaddish for my congregation, and I stand in for them here, there, everywhere." "Okay, so I'll sit shiva for 6 days, six days and a part of a day for my congregant. What wouldn't I do for my congregant?" So he was sitting shiva. This guy returned from his trip on the fourth day of the shiva, and he came to pay a call on the rabbi because the rabbi was sitting shiva. No, you didn't get it? Should I repeat it? Okay. It's stupid. It's a stupid story. It's what my daughter calls a rabbi joke. It has no meaning. Okay. Parental obligation. Father is responsible to see that the child is circumcised, taught Torah properly himself. He can't do it, then he has to hire somebody and pay whatever has to be paid. Father is responsible, and of course mother is part of this picture, of course, responsible to see that the child should be properly married, have the right bride. Something which is anathema today. Children tell you, "Mind your own business. Don't tell me whom I can go out with." You know, how many times have you said that to your own parents? "It's none of your business whom I'm going out with tonight." You know, but Jewish law says just the opposite. It is the business of parents to see to it that the children marry properly. The father is obligated to teach a trade to his child or children to make a living. Otherwise, they're going to end up thieves. You don't make a living, you have to steal, or kill, or mug. And there's one opinion even, according to Rabbi Akiva, that a father is obligated to teach his children to swim. All of these things that I mentioned are methods of survival. We survive by being Jewish, we survive by learning Torah, being knowledgeable, we survive by marrying in a proper manner, having a wonderful and decent family. We survive by having a trade, a profession, to make a living. And we survive sometimes physically by knowing how to swim, especially if we live in such areas where swimming is important for survival. Any questions about what I've said so far? The Jewish home should reflect many things. It should reflect Judaism. Not only be a home in which Jews are living, but it should have a library of Jewish books. Mezuzahs on the proper places, not only in the outside door, but on every door in the house that requires a mezuzah. Every door means every door, except for the closet door, except for the bathroom, but every other door must have a mezuzah. The Jewish home should have love in it. It should have harmony, tranquility, quietude, mutual cooperation. That does not mean that Rabbi Bamz is standing here saying there should never be a conflict in a Jewish home. But in the home, we're supposed to learn how to fight and not kill each other.
Yes. I heard one time a very nice explanation. They said, like, if you take the value of house when you move, if you take the value of the dust, and you take it from each other, you get 32, which is left, heart. So basically, it means if you take a house with a heart, you're sanctuary. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, it's a very technical statement that you made, beautiful. That the word bayit in Hebrew means a house, and the word mikdash means a sanctuary, and the difference would be 32. And 32 is the equivalent of lamed beis. Lamed beis is a lev, a heart. So if you put the heart into it, then you turn the house into a sanctuary. That's beautiful. That's very, very beautiful. And it's true. If there is love, and there is feeling, and mutual concern, and friendship. I told you last week we spoke about marriage and said, the most important thing is that a husband and wife should feel that they are the best friends. And if they feel it, their children will feel it. If they're enemies, their children will feel it too. And I repeat myself what I shouted just before. Conflict is not evil. It's not too good, but it's not evil. If we learn in a home how to handle conflict. And it's very important, because if we don't learn how to handle it, then outside the home we're gonna fail too. And we learn how to handle conflict without beating each other up, verbally, mentally, and physically. Brothers and sisters who learn how to argue and fight, but don't touch each other. Okay? That will happen in life too. You'll disagree with your partner, you'll disagree with your customer, you'll disagree with your client. So you disagree, so maybe you'll shout, maybe you'll be bitter about it, but you'll keep your hands to yourself. You won't pull out a gun and shoot. Today's arguments are being settled by children. Just yesterday, arguing between two children, one shot the other in the face. It's a mind-boggling. 135,000 children in the United States of America possess guns. It's monstrous. Why? And this is the way you solve your problem. Right? You have a disagreement, pull out the knife, pull out the gun, shoot. And the Jewish home is supposed to be a place of education where we learn how to live together. I have a fancy phrase I use all the time. You can learn it. The Jewish home is a social laboratory. It is the laboratory where we learn how to live together. Social laboratory. Or as my professor put it, it's a social laboratory. He pronounced the word laboratory. Laboratory. Okay? To make the Jewish home a sanctuary and a holy place, taharat ha-mishpacha, family purity, comes into play. Very, very important. We'll bring in a Rebbetzin to talk to the ladies about taharat ha-mishpacha. In general terms, gentlemen and ladies, it means that there is a period of time during every month, the cycle of every woman's menstrual period, when it is prohibited for men and women, husband and wife, to cohabitate and even to touch one another. And therefore the rules say don't hand the salt shaker, and don't hand the knife and the fork to one another, because Judaism has a very funny approach. It imagines that every husband and wife is in love. They love each other so much that if they come near one another, they're going to want to embrace. They're going to want to make love to one another. Imagine such a thing. You know what? Judaism says just that. Stay away at these particular times. Stay away, because if you get too close, then it will lead to the next step. And there, it incurs all kinds of punishments and breakdown in the purity of the home and of the marriage itself. And at the same time, it's psychologically sound, because as somebody said to me last week, was it? For me, every month is a new honeymoon. Why? Because almost for two weeks out of the month, my wife and I cannot touch each other, and then she goes to the mikveh, and she comes home after 5 days and 7 days, and then we can once again make love to one another. It's like renewing the whole bond, because you get tired of the nicest thing in the world. Try to eat steak every day, twice a day. You get so tired of it, it's going to creep out of your ears. Right? I like ice cream, but how much can you eat it? You say, sex is the same thing. If you abuse it, then it loses its beauty and its feeling, then it's just another animal act, because animals also have sex. And the love act is something which needs a rest. And needs anticipation. And says, okay, if you have almost a half a month, no touching. And the next half a month is a time of lovemaking. And it's beautiful, especially in Shabbat. Okay? That's family purity. Along with this, under this umbrella comes the rules of modesty, particularly for women, but for men as well. How to dress, so that we don't expose ourselves too much, because, strangely enough, this was written, I think, by Irma Bombeck, Harper, one of those columns that right, she said, a woman said it. If a man would say it, he'd be called a sexist. But she said, there's more rape reported today than ever before. Why? She said, because women are walking around with scantier clothing than ever before, especially in the summertime. What do they think? She wrote it, not me. She said, what do they think, these women? That men no longer have any passions? That they no longer look? And they are no longer excited? What, the men have changed, they think? No, they're the same animals that they were all the time. And being enticed this way, so they run, and they want to satisfy their excitement. And therefore, tzniut, as it's called in the Hebrew, modesty, dress, language is very important. for a married woman, it also includes covering the hair. The hair is considered as a particularly attractive part of a woman. And say of the Isha Erva, so the hair should be covered. Depending upon what kind of community one lives in, the method of covering the hair depends upon the husband, community, the rabbi in the community. For instance, I mean by that, if you live in Crown Heights, and you're a married woman, then you would not think of going with your hair exposed. You probably have a wig on. Yes. Well, let me answer you this way. Sephardic women mostly do not cover their hair. Even Ashkenazic women from the Lithuanian country until about 1950 also didn't cover their hair. I knew great rabbis and their wives who came from the Lithuanian country. The wives did not cover their hair. When the generation of Hungarian Jews who survived the Holocaust arrived here in 1946, 47, 48, they brought with them the strong custom of women covering their hair, even wearing the shetel, wig, and so it became part of the experience of the Orthodox Jewish community that women have to cover their hair. So to say to you that it's not a sin, that it is a sin not to go with hair covered, it's not a sin. The Talmud says that one great woman had 8 children, 8 sons, all of them became high priests, one after the other. And they asked, how come? What did she do to deserve that? And they said that the ceiling of her home never saw her hair. And she always went with her hair covered. So it is a good thing to do. That's why I say it depends upon the husband, depends upon the community. If you're going to move into Williamsburg, then you have to wear your hair covered. You may have to shave your hair off altogether, that kind of community. If you're going to be in a modern Orthodox, quote-unquote, community, then one can cover their hair with a hat, with a kerchief, whatever is the custom of that community, depending upon, again, the husband's desire as well. Yes? Why women shave their hair? In Hasidic, some Hasidic, they believe that the hair is so attractive to men that at no time do they want their hair to be seen. She should, but her husband also has to control his passions. A husband also has to control why he is having sex with his wife. Is it a love act, or is it an act of pure passion? And the more beautiful she is, the more difficult it becomes to differentiate between that. And then it's a matter of custom. I believe that custom is derived, Vicky, from an old, old problem. The Talmud tells us about it already 1,500 years ago, and this was a problem 300 years ago. It was the delight of the Polish dukes to have sex with a bride the first night after her marriage, before she even slept with her own husband, and they had the privilege of having sex with them. So the Talmud speaks about it, so it goes back a long time ago. Now, if a woman is to shave off her hair, and part of her beauty is gone, so what man wants to go to bed with her? So this was a method of survival. And then it becomes customary. After a while, something that's continued year after year, generation after generation, becomes tradition. Did you see Fiddler on the Roof?
Mm-hmm.
Tradition. You don't want to break their tradition. I believe historically that's where it may have been one of the roots of where it came from. Yichud, you saw the bride and groom were closeted in a room by themselves to show that they are married. The opposite is also true. A man and woman who are not married are prohibited from being confined in the same closed room together. They're not married. So this presents a problem to people who are morphuses and so on. How do you do it? And I think I told you this story once. I took courses in clinical psychology. So I sat in on one example of industrial psychologists who were meeting with personnel to be, people who apply for jobs. One fellow was a Hasidic boy, Hasidic young man with long face, hanging down, and he was being interviewed by a woman psychologist, personnel manager. And he walked into the office. Now we could see this. We were sitting behind a one-way mirror, one-way glass. We could see in, but they couldn't see us. And he walked into the room, went over to the chair that was in front of the desk. She went behind the desk, and before she went, she closed the door. And then she went to sit down behind her desk. He got up, and he opened the door. Mm-hmm. And then she sat down, she looked, the door was open, so she got up and she closed the door. And as soon as she went back towards the seat, he got up and he opened the door. This happened two or three times. And later when we were discussing what her reaction was to the entire interview, she said, "I immediately wrote on his record that he's claustrophobic. He cannot stand a closed door." Okay? And I was sitting there, there were two more rabbis in this course, and I said to her, "Dr. So-and-so, is it possible that that young man did not want to sit with you in a closed room, and that's why he was opening the door whenever he was able to do so?" She said, "Why should he not want to sit in it? Is it possible for religious reasons that he's not permitted to sit in a closed room with you? Really, he would pay as long, but obviously a Hasidic young man." So she said, "I never heard such a thing." I said, just because you haven't heard of it doesn't mean that it's abnormal. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you ask him, why are you closing the door? Such a simple question. And we could have gotten his answer. This way we don't know. We don't know whether he was claustrophobic or he was doing it because, I would bet that he's doing it for religious reasons. But I took a look at the guy. That she didn't appreciate that at all. She said, "I never heard such a thing, and therefore, even if it is because of a religious reason, it's a form of claustrophobia." It's going this way. It's Freudian, by the way, Freudian. So he says that religion is used as an expression of a phobia of some kind. But yichud is an important thing, especially for young people who are not married. You have to remember that this would be prohibited. One more remark. On October the 24th, that's today, we're supposed to talk about terminal illness, euthanasia, death, and mourning. We'll start with the terminal illness part of it and euthanasia. So much in the newspapers today. What's the name of this? Dr. Jaworski, and that's his name, who is helping people to die. The simple rule is that life stands higher than death. And while there is life, there is a hope that that person who is ill may recover. If we end that person's life, then it's murder. We're not supposed to touch a person who is in a coma, who is gasping for breath, in Hebrew called the goses. We're not supposed to aid or hasten the death of a person, even in the very last moment. If one does, it's considered murder, murder. Now, whether it's punishable or not, that's beside the point. If one is in a coma and so on, then we don't know if that's a viable person or not. But nevertheless, it's murder. It is murder abortion is considered murder, according to Jewish law, where it is not permitted. The fetus may be considered non-viable, non-wanted, but it's murder anyway. Terminal Illness today is presenting a very, very, painful problem economically, because people are living longer than ever before, and therefore they're ending up in facilities very sick, where the illness lasts for a long time. Science has advanced to such a degree, medical science, you can keep people alive who would have died many years ago, and they're still being maintained on the heroic equipment. Is it permitted to remove the respirator and the, what else? And the feeding tubes and the intravenous of a person who is going to die? The doctors say there is no hope whatsoever. Answer, no. Is it necessary to apply the heroic equipment, medical equipment, to someone whom the doctors feel is terminally ill?
I would answer yes.
And the answer is it, what's my question again?
Must you apply the life-saving technology? Not necessarily.
It will be left to the doctor whether the life of that person can be extended in any way by that heroic equipment, and the answer would be yes. But the doctor says, in his opinion, from two other colleagues of his, that there's nothing that can extend the life of that patient, and the patient is best off just living out his or her time and not applying the equipment. Then that would be proper, halachically speaking. Once it is applied,
you must have three opinions.
You should have three opinions, yes. And a rabbi should be in on this too, by the way.
A hypothetical situation, a non-Jew should be living with, where they choose not to have life put on, and that it's not, you know, it makes much of a difference. Want someone to be a witness
person who is going to be the witness of the jury, they would you allow to be a witness on something like that?
In general, the question is whether a Jew should be a witness for a non-Jew for any cause whatsoever. I see nothing wrong with it. If the living will is written in such a way that's acceptable. And we've debated a great deal about the living will. The rabbis. There is one form or two forms today that are being accepted. The only thrust of the living will is, if something happens, you must consult my rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
The rabbi is named and his address and telephone number, and he shall make the decisions as to what to do. That's the thrust of a permitted living will, according to Jewish law. Now, if it says anything else, it says that under no circumstances, even a doctor can say, can prolong the life of the individual, should any of this support system be applied, I don't think that a Jew should be witnessed for anything like that. No. Any other questions? Okay, that's internal illness. We're only touching euthanasia, mercy killing. You know, euthanasia is mercy killing. It's completely prohibited according to Jewish law. Completely. It's considered murder, period. Underlined 10 times. Dr. Jacobowitz, who was the chief rabbi of England until recently, about 2-3 years ago, wrote one of the earliest books on medical ethics, Jewish law and medical ethics. There are dozens of books on this subject today. And if you're interested in it, get a hold of Rosner's book, R-O-S-N-E-R, Dr. Rosner, Fred Rosner, Dr. Tendler's books on medical ethics, Dr. Bleich's book on medical ethics. So these are the standards today in Halakha, dealing with Jewish law and medical ethics. And all of them agree that the euthanasia is prohibited. And Dr. Jacobowitz makes the point that if euthanasia is going to be permitted, then how can we justify hating the Nazis? The Nazis also decided that it would be a merciful thing to kill all of the Gypsies and all of the Jews, right? And all of the Communists and all of the Catholics at one point. It's merciful for them. Their lives are valueless. They have no quality of life. So like insects, you put them out of existence. That's euthanasia, where quality of life is missing. Then you take the life away. And that could lead easily to Nazism. Now, Dr. Jacobowitz was attacked for that. Well, that has nothing to do. But the fact is that there's an underlying principle here. Once you say, we can decide who shall live and who shall die on the basis of what we think is quality of life, and if it's not quality of life, quality of life, therefore ended, that the euthanasia is, then how far will we go with that? We take the homeless person and say there's no life, there's no quality here either. Kill him or her. Get rid of him. Take the sick person, which the Nazis did. They shot all sick people. I was in a city called Lublin this summer in Poland, the Jewish hospital. The Nazis in 1942 came into that Jewish hospital, and there were 370 patients. They took them all out of the bed and shot them all, the sick people. They don't have to. Quality of life. So euthanasia is prohibited 100%. And death and mourning, is there anybody here who did not receive from me a pamphlet on death and mourning practices? Okay, I'll bring it next time. Please, God, in your session. Any questions? Any questions? Yes, suicide is the worst crime that any human being can commit, but life is not ours, it belongs to God, we have no right to end it. It's considered such as a sinful act that the family members do not have to sit shiva for a suicide. Who does not have a mental problem? I want to qualify that, because if it's a suicide of a man or a woman who has a mental history of some kind, then we don't consider that suicide. We consider the act of a sick person. Yeah. Good question. Mm-hmm. There are people who say that the Matzada Jews did not follow Jewish law. They were not permitted to commit suicide. All you have to do is read some of the work that came out of Dropsy College some years ago. Dr. Sidney Honig wrote about it. And there are negative opinions. You know what Masada is?
Yes.
In Israel, there's a place called Masada where 923 Jews who were running away from the Romans after the destruction of the temple were fortified, and the Romans were climbing up the mountains to attack their fortifications. and they all decided to commit suicide at the same time, and they are seen as heroes. Israel used this as a model. Matsada, Shemit, Lo, Tipo. Matsada will never fall again. This is the model of the state of Israel. Matsada will never fall again. Meaning, Tada is the symbol of Israel. Yes.
So, Colvin, would they actually say that there's only one suicide, that first they had
murdered
each other, so that wouldn't be
considered suicide. Uh-huh. At the end, the two names,
oh, yes.
I think it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So,
you saw the same show.
Who said that murder is permitted, right?
Right.
Anybody who does not have a set of questions, somebody asked me about it tonight. Well, thank you very much, Denise, for preparing them for us.
Beautiful.
What
do you got?
Don't have a full set of questions to be used for review purposes and learning purposes. Okay. Let me wish you well, everybody. I'm going to see you next week. Please, God.